Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The experts say that the best war films shine a light on our beliefs about sacrifice, heroism, and the very nature of war. And each of those qualities can take very different forms on the silver screen: anger, grief, courage, surrender, redemption, shock, and sometimes a bit of black humor. In the 1967 World War II film The Dirty Dozen, a U.S. Army major played by Lee Marvin addresses the 12 convicted felons he has been assigned to train and lead in a top-secret mission behind enemy lines to prepare for the D-Day invasion.
You've all volunteered for a mission which gives you just three ways to go. Either you can follow up in training and be shipped back here for immediate execution of sentence, or you can follow up in combat, in which case I will personally blow your brains out, or you can do as you're told, in which case you might just get by.
In honor of Memorial Day, Time Warner Cable is offering a special program of 10 historical war films, and we thought we'd take a look at the evolution of war films, past and present. Joining us by phone from Middletown, Connecticut, is Professor Janine Basinger. She is the chair of the Film Studies Department and the founder and curator of the Cinema Archives at Wesleyan University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us is, by phone from Greenbelt, Maryland, is Lawrence Seward. He is both a film historian and a military historian. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Thank you for inviting me.
We'll post a link for more information about the Time Warner Cable War Film Series on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Question for our listeners: do you have a favorite war movie? Give us a call and tell us what it is and why. 614-292-8513. So, The Dirty Dozen was inspired by a real-life group, The Filthy 13, and portrays how a group of misfits respond to the rigors of military training and the bonding required to carry out a mission like that. The film seemed to want to show how the unconventional, The Dirty Dozen, would have been wasted, devalued in the usual military processes and hierarchy, and it sort of feels like an anti-war film in many ways. Does the timing of the release of a film have anything to do with what the message is of the film? Janine?
Well, yes, obviously it does. I mean, films have to touch base with the audience in some way, and the war film is a really good indicator of where we are in our heads about our feelings toward war. I mean, when we're in a war, let's say World War II, and we're fighting it, although those films are more grim than people realize and often give you a sort of downer message because they can't very well indicate there's no death or whatever, but they're more optimistic, they're more justifying what war should be, why we're in it. Whereas when we're anti-war or fighting a war that we question, such as in the Vietnam era, they become much more anti-war, more questioning, more suggesting that this is a destructive process that will do no one any good. So they do reflect their times. Sometimes they get ahead of the times, sometimes they get behind the times, but war is a genre, and as such, it is sensitive to telling stories the way the film-going audience needs them to be told at a certain time. Once in a while, you have a film that steps out and goes above that and wants to be for the ages, a film like Paths of Glory, for instance, but mostly they do reflect the times they're in.
Larry Seward, I read that the World War II had three different eras of film for it: the pre-war, the in the war, and the post-war.
Right, right. The one thing, if I may, about what the films say is there's a famous quote, and I never remember which filmmaker said it, but if you have a message, send it by telegraph. So they've always seen the fact that films are first to entertain, to get people in, and if there's a message, it's in there by accident.
What about those eras in World War II? Were those conscious, or is that something you can look back on? Can you really say that much about, say, the Vietnam War era in films?
Well, if you go back, the pre-war, you had Army, Navy, Air Force preparedness films trying to prepare the American people for the fact we were going to have to fight. And Congress, there was isolationist senators who complained bitterly that Hollywood was drawing us into World War II. So you had the pre-war, and there's seven or eight of those films, Confessions of a Nazi Spy, Dive Bomber, etc. And then during the war, the films were for war effort, to show how we were going to win. And perhaps the most famous one is Air Force. in which the B-17 sinks half the Japanese fleet, and there's a shot where the Japanese flag goes underwater, you know, as the ship sinks. And that was a message that we may have had Pearl Harbor, but we were going to win in any case.
My guests are Janine Basinger. She's chair of the Film Studies Department and curator of cinema archives at Wesleyan University. She's the author of the book, The World War II Combat Film, Anatomy of a Genre. And also Larry Seward. He is the author of Sailing on the Silver Screen, Hollywood and the U.S. Navy, Guts and Glory, The Making of the American Military Image in Film, and is also co-author of Stars and Stripes on Screen, A Comprehensive Guide to Portrayals of American Military on Film. We're talking about military films. If you have a favorite film, war film, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Don't forget you can email us as well at wosu.org/allsides. And you can, at allsides@wosu.org. And you can go on the Facebook page as well. What were the purposes of something like the 1941 film Sergeant York, which is at the beginning, and it tells the story of a World War I hero, the most decorated and famous American hero of that war? Janine Basinger, what was the purpose of that? Because he was also anti-combat.
Yes, his story, he was a conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. His religious beliefs, you know, forbid him to kill, to go to war. So telling his story, the story of a man who learned that it wasn't going to be that simple. He needed to go support his country, and he ultimately becomes the top-ranked war hero of the era. That was a sort of, as Larry had said, preparedness kind of film for Americans. At that point, they began to think about, you know, the isolationists that were out there in our country trying to get people on board and giving them the idea that you may have to change your mind. You may have to re-see this material. This may become necessary. So as Larry said, you know, there's an era there of preparedness, and a lot of them are training camp films. They celebrate the military experience, but a lot of them were also World War I films where they used World War I and sort of retold that story to get us excited and interested and on board fighting 69th. And Sergeant York, of course, was a hugely successful version of that, which directly addressed the reluctance to fight, the unwillingness and the religious issues, and change them over to be more heroic and to accept the idea.
And likewise, Larry Seward, we look back at World War II through the lens of unrest over the unpopular Vietnam War.
Right. But of course, there's a real dividing point there. You end up the first, the post-World War II movies with the Green Berets. And that's really a World War II movie, just moved up. But then the war became so unpopular that Hollywood stopped making Vietnam War movies until after the war ended. So you have that division. And up until and including the Green Berets, it was assumed we were doing right because Hollywood had only shown the American military winning and doing the right thing. So this was sort of a shock when you start to question the military and its view that they're going to win and the light at the end of the tunnel and all that.
Let's hear a cut from Patton, a 1970 film directed by Franklin Schaffner.
Yeah.
George C. Scott played General George Patton in the 1970 film about the general's World War II career. We'll listen to a clip of the film's opening where Patton delivers a speech with an enormous American flag behind him.
Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans.
The opening speech with the American flag became an iconic moment. What was it? It was obvious. We were obviously losing a war when that film came out. Janine?
Go ahead, Larry.
Larry?
Well, I was just going to say that speech Patton gave twice, and it was almost identical each time, to his officers and men before they went over to France after Normandy. So that was his way. It's almost like a football coach's, locker room speech before they go out to play football. Patton was, Scott had been trying to make Patton for over 15 years, and so that was, he was working on it before Vietnam became an issue. So you can see what you want in it after the film comes out.
Yes, I think that's an important issue. I mean, the film does not necessarily endorse Patton or this point of view. I mean, the film is a very intelligent movie that won a great many awards, and it really does have a kind of, you know, you can see it the way you want to see it, more of an aspect to it. I think that it is true that war films, even during World War II themselves, did contain questions about heroism, about the war, about military obedience. They built that into the text of the film itself so that there, you know, people don't love the idea of going and getting shot, you know. I mean, so these questions were often cleverly incorporated into the film, which then answered the questions for the audience in a way that was positive or could be endorsing of the war. And that's an important aspect to remember. The questions, it's not that the questions don't appear in the World War II film. They do. And I think people tend to forget that. I mean, I was one of the things that surprised me a lot when I watched every one of the movies that was made during the war itself, that, you know, they didn't ignore the questions, but they resolved them to their own ends.
Well, you can get a feeling of the power of films with Patton in particular.
Yes.
People would go into it and say, where is Patton when we need him? Or they would go in and say, see, that's the problem. We had people like Patton preaching war.
Yes.
So you have both sides, and it depends how you come into the theater with your own views and how the film reinforces your views on either side.
That's always been the clever aspect of the Hollywood movie. It was always able to have its cake and eat it, too. You know, with a lot of subjects, crime, the role of women, whatever, they were often able to put the text in so that you could see it the way you needed or wanted to see it. And probably not very many people got their minds changed. Perhaps they did, I don't know. But, you know, it's a clever aspect of the Hollywood movie to be ambiguous so that they could appeal to the widest possible audience.
Because, of course, they were trying to sell tickets.
You bet.
Daryl Zanuck made The Longest Day. And he started out with Cornelius Ryan's book, and then Ryan started to object to changes that Zanuck was making. And Ryan would say, hey, I wrote the truth. And Zanuck would say, well, I have seats to fill. And so you had that conflict between the two men.
Bob, in Cincinnati, your favorite war movie is Patton.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us why.
My dad served under Patton. He was he got drafted twice, actually. He got drafted in 1938 when he was 30, and when he came home, he was on 3 days and the war broke out, and he got shipped back on a ship, and he went under Patton for the next 41 months, the whole time he was there and fought with Patton, and talked with him, shook his hand, and Patton was everything that my dad said that Hollywood tried to portray him. As far as he believed in, and my dad was very religious, and he believed in reading the Bible, and when you put God into what this country was founded on, and our forefathers, and the way my dad fought, he was there from the beginning to the end, and he had eight major battles. He was in eight major battles. And he had eight bronze stars, as well as the whole Eastern Asian medal. And he came through Africa with Patton when they took over at the Kasserine Pass, when the other general failed that mission, when the Americans went up against Patton. The other general was 50 miles behind lines, and Patton came through, and my dad was with him. He said, they don't look like soldiers. They don't act like soldiers. Why are they expected to fight like soldiers? And that's the kind of generals we need today, you know, to get people in shape,
okay.
You know. And And I heard a gentleman in a comment on it a while ago say that one of the big things about bringing the draft back was that so many people are obese. Well, that's why they have boot camp.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
What
All right.
Interesting.
And can I continue?
Okay. Well, Bob, you know what? We've got to take a break right now.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for your call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, we look at the soaring rate of teenage diabetes in this country and ask what in the world are we doing to our kids? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 75 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 85. Partly cloudy skies for tonight, a low of 66 degrees. Sunshine with a slight chance of rain on Friday, a high of 86. On the eve of Memorial Day, we honor the service and sacrifice of our men and women in uniform, their families, and all those who have given their lives for our country. Broadcast live from the U.S. Capitol, it's the National Memorial Day Concert, Sunday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
In honor of Memorial Day, we're talking about war and film with Janine Basinger, author and chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University, and also military and film historian and author Larry Seward. We'd like to know what your favorite films are from favorite war films are. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about the importance of authenticity. Let's start it off with a cut from A Bridge Too Far. It's a 1977 story about a failed mission during World War II, the Allied attempt to break through German lines and seize several bridges in the occupied Netherlands. In this scene, Brigadier General James Gavin, played by Ryan O'Neill, recruits Major Julian Cook, played by Robert Redford, for a dangerous mission.
We're going to take Nijmegen Bridge tonight. What's the best way to take a bridge?
Both ends at once.
I'm sending two companies across the river by boat. I need a man with very special qualities to lead.
Go on, sir.
He's got to be tough enough to do it. And he's got to be experienced enough to do it. Plus one more thing. He's got to be dumb enough to do it.
Again, that black humor. Larry, the movie was filmed at the actual location, although not the real bridge. Why not? And how important is it that a war film be shot on location like
When he talks about taking the Nijmegen Bridge, that was shot at the Nijmegen Bridge, except they came the other direction. They came from the side that the movie shows them going to, come, and in the movie it's coming from. There were things to do with the river and the bridges. But when they went to Arnhem, which was the bridge too far, Arnhem itself was very built up, and that there was too much traffic to shut down the bridge. So they went to Deventer, which is nearby, and apparently the Dutch have a blueprint for all their bridges, and the one at Deventer looked just like the one in Arnhem. The only difference was in the movie it shows some generals deciding to give up the battle on top of a church steeple, and it turns out there was no church steeple in Arnhem. The church was in Deventer, and it was such a pretty church, and the view was so good that the filmmakers simply shot that there. Dutch historians have told me that renders the movie illegitimate. I'm not sure about that.
Well, what Janine Basinger, what kinds of leeway can you give movie makers when it comes to authenticity?
I think you can give them a great deal of leeway if you want to. I mean, after all, we're not dealing. It depends really on how they present themselves. If a movie bills itself as the absolutely historically accurate recreation of an event, then I think you can hold it to that standard. If it says, we're telling you a story about something that happened during World War II and it was historically true, then you might get a little shaky. And if it just says, we've made up a story about people in World War II and this is what it is, then that is what it is. So, you know, I think movies are not documents unless they are documentaries, and even then they're not always documents. So this is a storytelling medium. You have to use your head when you go to the movie to realize if you're being given history, and as if history was accurate all the time anyway, but I think you have to look at it and be the judge. If it's purporting to be honest about a historical event, then let's have some accuracy. You know, I think it's, I wouldn't want to see a World War II combat film where they're throwing rocks instead of using guns and tanks, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is the storytelling aspect, I mean, to it. And so sometimes movies are recreating emotions, events, attitudes, not necessarily depicting the exact happening the way it happened. And who could do that anyway if you really had to? It could be very difficult.
Well, with A Bridge Too Far, I asked the screenwriter, I said, well, hey, you had really 10 bridges, 5 railroad and 5 road, but you only show 5. And he said, yes, because we did not want to confuse the audience too much. So,
yeah, you have a lot of issues in film. I mean, if you look at films like Gettysburg, where they actually go to the Gettysburg Military Park and mm-hmm. use 5,000 Civil War reenactors to try to make it accurate, then I think you can say, well, let's see if it is accurate because that's what it's telling us it is. Or even Longest Day, which is also sets out to recreate the invasion at Normandy. But, you know, if you have a more a story, you know, that is more loosely based in fact, filmmakers have issues that they cannot recreate the complexity of history. And in some ways, as Larry said, you go to the site and it doesn't look the same. You can't do it the same. So, you know, you have a lot of issues there.
Well, with The Longest Day, they did go to Normandy.
They did.
And they went to Utah Beach. And the story I liked best was one of the Rangers who recreates going up Point de Hoc actually was there in 1944 going up Point de Hoc. And they said, well, was it the same? And he said, well, no, it was just as confusing. But in the real event, when the people fell down, they died. In
yes.
our movie, the extras got up and went back up the hill a second time.
Well, one of the best things ever said about this issue was said by the film director Samuel Fuller, who was, in fact, a World War II combat veteran. He had been in the Big Red One. And he said, if you want accuracy for a combat or war film, the only way you can really get it is, you know, while the audience is sitting there, troops come in and start shooting at them. And, you know, I've always loved that. You know, I mean, there is that issue, isn't there? How are you going to get it accurate?
Well, with A Bridge Too Far, the movie, of course, is a movie. But at the museum at Arnhem, they actually have documentary footage, which some filmmaker or cameraman went along and took. So you can look at that movie and then go outside and look at the way they've recreated the battlefield.
We do have a lot of documentary footage on the wars, all of them now, and those are showing on the History Channel a great deal. So you do have a chance to look at footage more and more is released or processed all the time. And one of the things I've always thought about with Vietnam is, as Larry said, you didn't have Vietnam movies during that period of time. It was only afterwards that you got them. But you had Vietnam combat every night on
yes.
your TV set. Who needed images of it at the movies? You had it. All you had to do was turn on the TV, and you were looking at the Vietnam War. So the
Absolutely.
Movies didn't need to do it for us. We had it.
There. Let's hear from Josh. And if you would like to give us a call, you can call us at 614-292-8513. We'd like to hear what your favorite war movie is. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Josh, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me, and welcome, Dr. Basinger. My favorite war movie is really a departure from the genre.
Well, that's why I went to you next, because this is not exactly an authentic.
Yes. So this movie is Stalag 17, I think 1959, Billy Wilder.
Right.
And
of course.
And it's really a story about, to me, an anti-hero. But there are these elements, I think, from other war movies that are there, such as camaraderie,
yes,
of these men who are under conditions in a POW camp in this particular condition. And then there's, I think there's still a patriotism theme, especially with how, they kind of portray the Germans still. And this is 1959, over a decade,
yes,
after the war ended. The Germans are certainly portrayed as evil, but also as buffoons. So I'm wondering if you could comment on how this movie, which is clearly a Hollywood comedy in some ways, fits into the genre overall. Thank you.
And
sure.
Thank you, Josh. And then also how it fits, how the,
yes,
enemy is depicted in war movies.
Well, the thing is, Stalag 17 is based on a stage play, so it was locked into that format. But, if you think about, you mentioned the issues, sacrifice, heroism, historical accuracy, and nature of war. That film, Stalag 17, does address all of those issues. And as he says correctly, it is about patriotism also, and it's about who is the hero, who is the enemy, how do they behave. And it's about people inside the Stalag needing to pull together, people of different backgrounds, religions, attitudes, who need to pull themselves together into an organized unit to work and do what they have to do in order to save themselves. And so it definitely reflects the experience, and it's almost like all the guys from other combat movies show up in there. There's an Air Force guy, there's an infantry guy, and I think that's really interesting that he chose that. It is a very funny movie, but it's also a serious movie, and I think that's a good choice. I mean, it doesn't have hand-to-hand combat. It has a little bit of fighting and escape and people shooting, but it definitely reflects the issues of the war movie.
I think POW movies are subgenre.
Yes.
There's The Great Escape,
yeah,
and there's Fred Zinnemann's Act of Violence, which is only set for a few minutes at the POW camp, but it's the basis for action of people afterwards. What happened there? Why did the Germans do what they did? And how does that reflect on the characters' post-war experiences?
Let's listen to another cut. This is from Full Metal Jacket. The story follows two Marines through training and their experiences during the Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War. In this scene, the drill sergeant tells the new recruits what it means to be a member of the Marines.
Today, you people are no longer maggots. Today, you are Marines. You're part of a brotherhood. From now on, until the day you die, wherever you are, every Marine is your brother. Most of you will go to Vietnam. Some of you will not come back. But always remember this. Marines die. That's what we're here for. But the Marine Corps lives forever. And that means you live forever.
Lyra, you've talked about an enduring theme across the eras of war films is how young, innocent boys are turned into men and learn the issue of pulling together and teamwork, or I guess in the case of Goldie Hawn's role in Private Benjamin, a woman does. But what about that scene and what about that film in terms of that question?
The whole point of basic training is to make sure that the soldiers will obey orders when they're given. So if you're told to go up the mountain, and you won't say, but sir, there's a machine gun up there, I may get killed. You go up the mountain because you're told. I think the best statement of that maybe was in the Kane Mutiny, where at the end, after the trial has taken place, Fred McMurray confronts
the journalist, and I think it's Fred McMurray, but in any case, says your job was to help the captain, not attack him. And I think that's the whole point of training, whatever the service was, that you do what you're told to do, and you fight only for, really, your neighbor next to you, not for the war, I mean, not for the country. And that's what the films try to show.
One of the interesting things about that particular clip there with Full Metal Jacket is Lee Ermey, who actually, the actor, was actually a Marine drill sergeant. I mean, and he actually does that so authentically that it's kind of hair-raising. The best part of Full Metal Jacket, I always felt, was the first half at basic training, because it depicted so clearly what Larry just defined there, and Lee Ermey was so much a part of making that real, and it was a glimpse into something a little bit different. The combat part of the film in Vietnam, I don't think is quite as strong as the training camp part.
You know, Janine, you bring up something when you mentioned Lee Ermey. I've never heard of Lee Ermey. I'm just a regular old, you know, moviegoer.
Okay.
He is fantastic, right? But I wondered about the idea when we talked about A Bridge Too Far. When so many of the characters are played by such famous actors, whether that goes into the authenticity, whether it's difficult to imagine this really happening when they're such familiar faces.
Well, you know, when you look at The Longest Day and you see John Wayne and you see Robert Mitchum and they play these famous generals, there's something about that works. Of course they would be our great World War II combat movie heroes, wouldn't they? There's something about that works.
Well,
instead of making it less, it for film goers, it's like it has a kind of strangely reverse authenticity. And just before you speak a minute, Larry, I just want to say, you know, Lee Marvin from Dirty Dozen, he was a World War II hard-nosed, hard times combat veteran. And so he also knew what it was like to go hand-to-hand in battle. So he brought that authenticity. Even though he was a movie star, he'd been there.
Well, part of using the actors is so the people remember them, particularly in The Longest Day, mm-hmm. where no one is on the screen very long, mm-hmm. but you can remember it that way. If we go back for a minute to Full Metal Jacket, it shows the problems of filmmaking. Stanley Kubrick wanted to make a Vietnam movie. He hadn't even seen the newsreels back in the United States because he lived in England, and his art director told him that there was really two movies there, and that there had to be two movies, and Kubrick would not listen to him, so the art director resigned. So it's part of making a film, you have to get people to agree on what you're going to do or stand up for your rights. In this case, the art director simply walked off the set.
Janet in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Janet.
Hi. My favorite movie is Audie Murphy's To Hell and Back, and mostly because it's not an in-your-face war movie. Yes, there's, you know, shooting and killing, and it's war. It sort of was even-handed, I thought, and went to the more of a very personal place, you know, especially since Audie was one of the ones who helped sort of bring out the PTSD issues that happen, mm-hmm. and so forth and so on. But I just thought it was a really well-done movie, and I just wondered what the historians thought of it.
Okay, thank you, Janet.
Oh, well, do you want to go first? Or?
Well, I can have to pass. I've seen the film, but a long time ago, and so I can't say much about it except that it was capitalizing on the fact he was a great hero and good-looking,
mm-hmm.
and it was an interesting story.
Well, I would say that I like the film, too. I mean, I agree with the caller in the sense that since Audie Murphy was himself the most decorated soldier of World War II, and this is an autobiographical movie for him, it brings to it, you know, a story that is about an average guy who goes into the war, survives it, and becomes, you know, not only a survivor but a war hero. And the battle sequences in that film are actually excellent, and so, you know, it does have a but it isn't, it's low, she's correct, you know, it's a bigger story than just war and combat. It's the story of his life and where he came from and where he went. And so it's a very interesting variation on the war film.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In honor of Memorial Day, we're talking about war and film with Janine Basinger, author and chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University, and also military and film historian and author Larry Seward. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with gardening tips for the summer with author and Ohio's garden sage, Deborah Kanapke, joining the show. That's from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.
A basic membership to 89.7 NPR News starts at just $60 and helps to keep the news and programming you enjoy on the air. Make your first-time gift or renew your basic membership. And you'll get the WOSU member card, too. Just visit WOSU.org. 75 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, and a hot day, a high of 85. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 66 degrees. Some sunshine with a slight chance of rain on Friday, a high of 86. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
In honor of Memorial Day, we're talking about war and film with Janine Basinger. She's author and chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University, and also military and film historian and author Larry Seward. Let's listen to a cut from the 1989 film Glory. It's based on the true story of the 1st Regiment of African-American soldiers during the Civil War. In this scene, the commanding officer, Robert Gould Shaw, played by Matthew Broderick, tells his men that they're going to be paid $10 a month instead of the usual $13 because they're black.
I mean, a color soldier stop a bullet just as good as a white one. And for less money, too. Yeah, old Uncle Abe got himself a real bargain here. Hey, what you say, Buck?
That's right. Slaves. Uh-huh. Step right up, make your mark.
Get your slave wage.
Yeah, you say? All you good color boys, go ahead and sign up.
That's right. Head up.
If you men will take no pay, then none of us will.
Interesting movie. It's one of those war films that works on being epic, but also focuses on individuals. Does it succeed in that, Larry Seward?
I guess I'll have to pass on that. Sorry.
Okay. How about you, Janine Basinger?
Well, yes, I think it does. I mean, this is a case of where the war film is actually, it has a different purpose. I mean, its purpose is to restore our knowledge of this first unit of black soldiers during the Civil War. So it's about, it's using the war combat situation to teach us a different lesson or to teach us a different kind of lesson about what happened to the black soldiers who had to fight. And that's like the recent film Red Tails, I mean, which is about combat, aerial combat, but is also more about teaching us about what happened to the Tuskegee Airmen. And so, you know, like for those of us studying the form of the combat or war film specifically, I like this movie. I think it's a very good movie. The actors in it are fabulous, and one of the reasons it works is because you have Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, mm-hmm. and it embodies these characters, and you're looking at a story about characters, and you're in it for a different purpose. So I think that's just different for me.
I should say that the character that was yelling out
it
was, of course, Denzel. Well, at the end it was Broderick, but at the beginning it was Denzel Washington.
Yes.
Terry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Hi. You mentioned Lee Marvin a couple times. He's in my favorite war movie. It's a movie called Attack, directed by Robert Aldrich. I wondered if your guests had seen this movie.
Well, absolutely. A great movie. No. I mean, for me, it's one of my favorite war films. So I agree with you. What is it you especially, what draws you to it especially?
I think just seeing the other side of, different from the standard patriotic movie, this sort of the cynicism, the way that the Lee Marvin character tries to promote the political career of a cowardly leader, and yet then he gives his life at the end of the at the end of the movie.
Yes, and it's very, very well directed by Robert Aldrich. I mean, and I like that film a lot. It's a reenact. It's a Battle of the Bulge movie, and it has a cowardly captain played by Eddie Albert, and it's a very. It avoids what some people think of as war cliches, but it nevertheless does keep to the format of the war film, and I've always liked that movie a lot.
It has one interesting thing. It was just about the first movie about World War II that the Army refused to cooperate on.
Aldrich came to
the Army with wanting some help, a tank and a couple things, and because the enlisted man shoots the officer,
yes,
the Army said no, they would not help. So it's really the first post-war movie that does not get cooperation in any form from the military.
Glad you like the movie too. Thanks.
Thank you, Terry. Let's see. Why don't we quick listen to a cut from Saving Private Ryan, 1998 film directed by Steven Spielberg. It was an epic war film, begins with the invasion of Normandy in World War II, and then tells a fictional story about a group of soldiers who go behind enemy lines to bring home the last surviving brother of four servicemen. Let's listen to a scene where Captain Miller, played by Tom Hanks, finally meets Private Ryan, played by Matt Damon.
It doesn't make any sense, sir. Why? Why do I deserve to go? Why not any of these guys? They all fought just as hard as me.
Is that what they're supposed to tell your mother? When they send her another folded American flag?
Tell her that when you found me, I was here, and I was with the only brothers that I have left. And that there's no way I was going to desert them. I think she'll understand that.
That movie was noted for its graphic and realistic portrayal of war, especially the intensity of its opening 27 minutes, which depicts the Omaha Beach assault of June 6, 1944. Larry, Seward, authentic? Any gripes?
It would take 5 hours for me to comment. The problem is severalfold. It's not accurate. There's really no movie in the sense that what you see in the first 24, 25 minutes are supposedly Private Ryan's experiences on Omaha Beach, but he was a paratrooper and landed 17 miles inland, and so he could not have had those images. And therefore, Spielberg is manipulating, and he says at one point, defending the film, that only he knew how to make war movies because he knew how to put violence on the screen. But he had never been in the military, and he knew nothing about the military. So, I have real problems with its authenticity, plus the whole business. He says he can use violence, and yet a year later he said that off-screen violence was much, much more frightening than on-screen violence. So he contradicts himself and simply makes a movie that has very little accuracy in it. As you can tell, I don't like it very well.
Janine.
Well, the interesting thing, when Saving Private Ryan came out, it was generally celebrated a great deal by critics and audiences and also veterans for three things. One, the sort of realistic combat violence. Two, they said an unusual story format in which soldiers question leadership and the point of their mission, and three, sort of saying it had a new and different purpose. Actually, we had seen some pretty grisly violence before. The film Beach Red, done by Cornell Wilde, has a landing on a Pacific island with, you know, severed limbs floating by and lots of gore and guts. And you know, I'd actually seen that before. The story format is the same one we're familiar with, which is a group that is diverse, that undertake a mission with a leader, et cetera. But it did have a new and different purpose in that I think, this is my opinion, in that at the end, there's the issue, has Private Ryan, who is the representative American, lived a life worthy of those who died in World War II? So it's kind of like, did we earn this is the question. You know, people sacrificed, people who go in combat die for their country. They sacrificed, and we're supposed to look at ourselves as a nation and say, did we earn this? And that question is directly asked of the viewer at the end of the film. So it's not, I didn't feel the film's point was historical accuracy as much as it was something about modern America using the old format more to make us ask ourselves some questions about where we were as we were watching that film. But you know, look, I'm not a military historian, and Larry is, you know, and I respect.
Maybe
you know,
it's a bliss of ignorance, right, Janine?
Pardon? Yeah, ignorance is bliss.
You know, the
I understand the point.
Sure.
I you know, there's a lot of issues here, and this was a film that created a lot of discussion with people.
Well, there's two sides. The D-Day veterans did object, at least to me, strenuously about the inaccuracies, but then they had to concede that it reminded the American people of their courage and bravery many years after the fact. So you had two sides of their view of it.
Okay. Justin in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Hey, Ann, thanks. Love the show.
Thank you.
I was wondering if your panelists might comment on a World War II story that's more commonly remembered for the novel form, and that is Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. And the reason I ask is because I think it's a very unique take on the war and the post-war journey of the soldier. And I think Hollywood really should give it another crack because the original, I don't think, was very well promoted or that many people are aware that an adaptation ever took place.
Thoughts?
Well,
Janine?
Well, that film was a failure. You know, I've only seen that film once, really. And it seemed, as I recall it, you know, it's the character Billy, the Billy Pilgrim thing, mm-hmm. who's, you know, it's not really, oh, gee, I don't know what to say about that. To me, it's not a war film. I put it over in another category. It was a big budget film of its day, but when you have a fantasy novel like that to turn into a movie, you get a great many challenges. I think that I have to defer to Larry on this.
You know, you bring up a point. That's fantasy in a war movie. There's a lot of war movies are westerns in a war movie.
Well,
taking one genre and just flipping it into the war genre.
Otto Preminger told me that war movies and westerns are the same thing. The good guy chases the bad guy, and at the end, the good guy kills the bad guy. So in that sense, westerns and war movies are basically the same. I think the fantasy, though, Catch-22 would be a better example,
yeah.
Which I call a noble failure. On one hand, it's the problem of how do you transfer something, a novel like Catch-22, to the screen. And then, of course, they advertised it as an airplane movie, which it wasn't. So, you know, you have these problems with studios and how they try and sell things. And in the case of Slaughterhouse-Five and Catch-22, you had a best-selling novel, and they couldn't figure out how to put it onto the screen. Even Mike Nichols couldn't with Catch-22.
Thanks to Justin for that call. Let's try to squeeze in one more caller. Graham in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. One of my favorite movies, I love old British black and white movies of the 50s. I don't know, they have a mm-hmm. grittiness to them. But one of my favorites is a movie called Ice Cold in Alex. I look it up and I actually see that it was released in the U.S. under Desert Attack. But it's with John Mills. But it's one of the first movies that show a sympathetic view of a German not really a prisoner, but a German escapee. I don't know if you know it. It's about four escapees from Tobruk getting back across the Western Desert towards Alex. And the point is that they're going to make they want to have an ice cold beer in Alexandria. And it's just a great movie. It also depicts how, in many cases, especially in World War II, but even to this extent, is sometimes the combatants are combating a third element, which is the desert in this case, or the ocean in other cases.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
Well, there's a British movie that I think captures some of that, is The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. And you have the German and the Brit and their lives, how they've interacted over a long period of time. And it raises questions about war and about obeying orders and all that sort of thing.
I couldn't hear. My telephone did not pick up what the gentleman was saying, so I have no idea what to say.
Well, he said his favorite movie was Ice Cold in Alex.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I know that film. Okay, well, that's the linking of the two different sides, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
That's okay. Well, I just had one more quick question, and we only have about a minute, so we'll have to speed through it. But back in 2003, Janine, you were quoted in a New York Times story about the public's appetite for war films and how it has seemed to wane. You refer to that 24-hour news channels as part of the explanation.
Well, you know, we need the stories we need when we need them, and we have plenty of war available to us if we need it on our TV, not only on news channels, but in the old movies on the History Channel. And, you know, the thing is that the war film does not ever really go away, and it surfaces in a way that Larry was referring to earlier, which is it shows up in other genres. I mean, what is Battleship here? What is the Avengers? I mean, these films have combat in them. They have wars in them. Mm-hmm. They're opposing forces. They're not realistic, but they come back to us in new ways. Red Tails came out this year. I mean, a World War II combat film. I mean, it never really goes away, mm-hmm. but I don't think you have, you know, because until war goes away, I don't, but
that's not going to happen anytime soon. I'm sorry. Yeah. We've run out of time. Janine Basinger, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Janine Basinger, she's a film studies department chair at Wesleyan University. Also, Larry Seward. Thanks so much, Larry.
Yeah.
Larry Seward, he's a military historian, film historian, and author. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.